You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has long provided help for homeschooling parents through her Brave Rider educational program. But with the pandemic, where kids and frankly all of us are spending more time online, Julie Bogart began thinking about how kids interpret what they read or see online. How can we teach children to discern facts from interpretation, bias and opinion from belief? Her latest book offers parents some tools for their kids at every point of child development. While it's designed for parents who are teaching their children, it also contains great observations for all of us as we negotiate this 24/7 abundant news and information world we're all immersed in. Bogart is the creator of the Brave Rider program that teaches writing and language art. She has over 20 years' experience developing curricula for parents as well as her now 5 grown children. Her new book is titled Raising Critical Thinkers, A Parent's Guide to Growing Wise Children in the Digital Age. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Julie Bogart, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What was the inspiration for this book on critical thinking? I know you've got your Brave Rider educational program for parents teaching their children how to write better. What inspires you to write about critical thinking?
You know, honestly, the internet. I was in my late 30s when the doors flung open, and I was a homeschooling mother at the time. And I think homeschoolers were the first ones through the doors, honestly. We were all so desperate to connect with other people and to have opportunities to get bits of wisdom or ask advice. But what I discovered very quickly is that this homogeneous group of people, stay-at-home moms, mostly heterosexuals, you know, similar religious orientation, homeschoolers, we fought about everything. Whether or not to use cloth diapers, how long to breastfeed, whether or not to co-sleep. We got into, you know, theological bloodbaths and political arguments. And I just couldn't understand why there was so little patience with someone who had a different point of view. And so it led me to this sort of quest to really digest what was happening online. I mean, we were saying things to each other that no one would ever say at a park day, right? And so because those two experiences were living in such a side-by-side way, I became fascinated with how we form our viewpoints, why we're so attached to them, why we believe we're right and someone is wrong so automatically. And that really led to this quest. Of course, at the same time, I was educating my own children and running this company where we were teaching writing. And critical thinking is so important in research-based writing. And so the combination of all those elements just took me on this journey to the point where I finally felt I have a book's worth of things to say about this. And so I wrote a book.
It's interesting in your introduction or the foreword by Barbara Oakley, you know, she comes out and says, you know, I was asked to help design a program that would help encourage critical thinking. She says, well, what's your definition of critical thinking? And I think it is pretty nebulous, that whole idea. It's obviously not taking something at face value. It's doing some examination of a statement or an opinion or argument and thinking about the components of it. Is it factual? What biases are a part of it? But there's real no easy definition to what is critical thinking. Do you have a working one?
I do, actually. And I think we should start with sort of the foundation of what I think critical thinking is. So a lot of us think that it is evaluating someone over there and finding the holes in their belief system or their assertion. So we're looking for what's wrong with what someone else thinks, and therefore we're a critical thinker. But to me, critical thinking starts with self-awareness. We aren't able to consider someone else's point of view until we know our relationship to that idea. So for me, critical thinking is the ability to evaluate evidence, but also first to notice bias as it kicks into gear and to consider a variety of perspectives, even when they make you uncomfortable. You can't even render a possible verdict, what you believe is true, without doing those steps first, because otherwise you will just be reactive. You'll just be talking from this invisible set of assumptions and beliefs and conditions that shape how you think, before you've actually been able to encounter what they're saying. You're only being influenced by what's happening inside you, not by the content of what they're saying.
We'll talk a little bit about self-awareness in a moment or so, but you know, for many of us, the last few years have resulted in so many of us moving to one of two camps, and everything from public health to politics to identity, virtually any issue, we're in one camp or the other camp. And when we're in our camp, we hear information pretty uncritically. And when we're hearing something from the other camp, if we're listening at all, it's with extreme skepticism. To me, this does not seem to be a workable relationship for, working towards a more perfect union, which is what our country's about. How do we break down those barriers?
I love that you bring this up, because that really is a meaningful frame. There is an author named John Rawls who wrote a book called Justice is Fairness, and he does such a great job of describing the challenge of living in the kind of democracy that we have, a constitutionally controlled democracy. Basically, he asserts this, that we have individual rights that we're trying to protect at the same time that we're trying to honor community values or community beliefs. And those two come into conflict all the time. So when I was reading this book and thinking about what critical thinking is, it occurred to me that we are living inside with a tension between our personal perceptions and our community values, the way our communities define reality for us, in a similar way to how we're navigating democracy in our culture. So what that means is this: I might have a personal perception. I absolutely love to eat sweets, cake, cookies, because they taste good. And as a child, that's what I would say. I want a cookie. I want cake. There is a certain point where the community comes in and reshapes my personal perception to align with the community. And so a parent is a member of a community that says, sugar in excess is not good for you based on science. The dentist says it, the doctor says it, the Diabetes Foundation says it. So they start modifying the child's belief that sugar is universally yummy by giving them more information. Over time, we develop attachments to the logic stories of our communities, be they religious, political, social groups, ethnic identity, what have you. And those groups give us a logic story that tells us how to think, what to believe, and often even overturns personal perceptions. Those affiliations are so meaningful to us that we risk our membership to consider thinking away from them. For critical thinking to flourish again in our culture, our communities have to be taught to value dissent, to value doubt, to value intrusion of another perspective, to not assume that because we've always thought this was true, it must stay being thought of as true. We have to value people coming in with additional logic stories, personal perceptions, experiences, and so on, so that we can enrich ourselves. Doesn't mean you have to give up your community just because you're thinking differently from them, at least for a time being.
Yeah. Conversely, sometimes community values are in conflict with our greater ideals.
Completely true.
Yes.
Completely true. And to be able to name that without being pilloried for it, that is the key. And this is why I wrote a book that was not for adults trying to do this in the adult world, because, you know, let's face it, it might be too late for us. but our children are being raised in a community, and that's the family. And so if the family can be a safe place for dissent against the family values, for challenge to exist, for a child to say, I really don't think video games are harming me, and the parent actually takes that seriously enough to do some testing with the child. All right, let's see how long you can play before you get tired. All right, I'll play with you. I want to see what's happening on the screen. All right, I want to hear more about where that's coming from. If that can occur, we actually start to teach our kids how to form their thoughts, how to evaluate their own beliefs, how to test them in the real world and see how they hold up.
You know, it's interesting. You said this is really geared for children, and there are exercises for multi-age children at the end of each chapter for parents who may be homeschooling or just working with their kids.
Any parent.
Yeah, right.
Any parent for
sure. But it's really, I thought it was good for any of us that want to think with more nuance and more detachment. There are really wonderful ways of sort of slowing down. And I think that's, I think several times, having some detachment, having some dispassionate towards any statement you hear that automatically sort of puts your hackles on edge. I think
absolutely.
I think you caught on to my
subliminal task. I really felt that parents needed these skills themselves before they can impart them to their kids. So even if you don't have children, there is a ton in this book that will be valuable to you just as an adult. So yes, you're right about that.
My guest today is Julie Bogart. She's the creator of the Brave Writer Educational Program for homeschooling parents and children. And her latest book is titled Raising Critical Thinkers, A Parent's Guide to Growing Wise Kids in the Digital Age. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, in your introduction, you have a wonderful, charming example that you refer to throughout the book, an example of a critical thinking exercise that occurred while you were cleaning out your grandparents' home following your grandfather's death. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so I have a mother, and my mother has two sisters. She has a brother too, but this story is about the three daughters. So I was at my Aunt June's house. She's a former nun who became a religion and ethics professor at the University of California, Riverside. So very serious-minded, academic, smart woman, my inspiration. And then they have a much younger sister. This youngest sister is 18 years younger than my mother, so from another generation. And she was kind of a flower child rebel in the 60s and 70s. So we're going through this box of letters that my grandfather had saved over the years. And we come across a collection of letters without stamps and unsealed envelopes. And so I pull one out and I discover these are letters that my grandfather was writing to my grandmother in the nursing home. They were living in the same room. But my grandmother was suffering from dementia and was losing her memories and her ability to speak. So he wrote her a letter every week, and then he would read it to her. So I pulled this one letter out and started reading it. And wouldn't you know, he writes this line. He says, "Remember, Eva, when we climbed to the top of the hilltop where the first time I made love to you." And all of the sudden, I was in shock, because these were Catholic grandparents who had for my whole life been against living together, premarital sex. And I'm reading these words that he had first made love to her. And so I immediately read it aloud to my aunts. "Hey, listen to this, get a load of this." Well, my Aunt June, the former nun, immediately shut me down. "That can't mean what you think it means." And I said back, "What do you mean, June? I think they took a roll in the hay. Come on, it's romantic." And my younger Aunt Siobhan said, "You mean they lectured me about virginity before my marriage and they were already having sex back in the 1930s? Right? So we had this spirited exchange. And in that moment, I realized this was a challenging dilemma, because the words "to make love" in the 1930s did not mean sex. They meant to put the moves on the woman of your dreams.
Yeah, you're wooing.
Kind of like, yeah, just like what you see in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. So I knew that was true then, but my grandfather had written this letter in 1997. He surely knew that those words meant something different today. So we were left with this interpretation task. And naturally, both of my aunts were interpreting this language through the lens that they wanted to be true. My Aunt June wanted my grandparents to be faithful Catholics, and my younger Aunt Siobhan wanted them to be secret rebels, right? And so that's how they understood that language. But the truth of the matter is, my grandfather was gone. We will never know if it was a deathbed confession or if he was just trying to awaken his wife's addled mind with familiar language. We won't know. Interestingly, I've shared this story now in my entire extended family. Anyone under 40 is convinced they were banging, right? Like that's what they think. And then everybody older is like, "No, they were good Catholics." So it's very interesting to me how we bring so much of our own experience to this discussion when we're doing interpretation. And that's why I opened with that story, because I thought it was a good one.
Yeah. And of course, that leads right into some of the first sections of your book, which is learning to discern fact from opinion, from bias. And you go through the various steps in that, from what is a fact to what is an opinion, what is bias,
yes.
what is a narrative, a story, and figuring out the differences and how you need to read each accordingly.
Right. So what I think happens for a lot of us is we're flying through our social media feed and people are saying things like, well, it's just my opinion, or, well, you can't tell me that's not my opinion. When the word opinion is pretty loaded, actually, an opinion is something you render after you have considered a wide variety of perspectives and data and people who challenge the established data, right? You've got the status quo understanding, and then you've got the challenge to the status quo. And you can only truly render an opinion if you have the appropriate experience and education. Like, I cannot actually give an opinion on climate change because I'm trained in the humanities. I can't evaluate any of the methods, any of the tactics, any of the techniques. What I can offer you is, I believe the opinion of this person for whatever my personal reasons are. So when we're using some of this language, we're using it not only improperly, but we're using it to shame and control each other. It would be so much better if we said something along the lines of, well, my perspective today is this, or my viewpoint today is this, based on these people who I credit with having the authority. And that would be a beginning of changing this sort of hostile nature of our conversations. So yeah, I do think the vocabulary actually matters.
Another key aspect is being dispassionate about opinions you read, especially opinions you don't agree with. What are some of the exercises you use to look at a challenging viewpoint or opinion or perspective and take that extra time to find motivations to understand where the writer is coming from?
I like to check in with my body. So the first thing I do is I notice, is my heart racing? Am I breathing fast? Am I feeling a surge of triumph or anger? Do I have a sense that I'm nervous reading this article, or I'm nervous that someone would find out that I'm reading this article? I remember one time doing a search on a topic that I was in an argument with my husband about. And so I came down in the middle of the night to use my computer while he was asleep. And then I read all of the, you know, heretical information that I knew he didn't agree with. And then I cleared my cache so he would never know that that had happened. Right? Like, if you're doing that, you are not critical thinking, because what's happening is you're being controlled, right? In my case, I was trying to escape the control of thinking that was trying to control me. So when I'm reading, I ask myself before I start the article, what do I hope will be true? Because that clues me into the perspective that might take over the reading. And then I pay attention to when I want to skip something, when I want to argue with it, when my body is reacting, because those are the points that usually need me to slow down and listen for what's at stake for the writer. Why is this writer making this case that I don't like? He likes it or she likes it. So what is it for that person that is making it important for me to hear?
You know, it was interesting. As I was reading about your book, I read a couple of op-eds about the current situation in Ukraine. And I first read an op-ed by Fiona Hill. At the end of January. And, you know, she was famous for the Trump impeachment trial. She's a Soviet expert. And she was saying, Putin has the West exactly where he wants them, and laid out some really fine arguments. Then just a couple of days later, there was an Eastern European political specialist who said, Putin's in a trap of his own making. He stepped into his own trap. And through those two articles, you know, I just really had, it really opened my eyes to two very learned people seeing the situation completely differently. Each had very good arguments. And it was like, I'm still chewing over that several days later. I think that's one of the things, critical thinking, that's a critical thinking skill you really have to develop.
I love that. That is absolutely the perfect example. And of course, Fiona Hill representing a Western point of view, an American point of view, an Eastern European coming with a completely different history, completely different relationship to the Soviet Empire when it was an empire, right? So I think that's one of the things that we always have to remember. One of the questions we can ask our kids when they read anything or they share any information with you is just to say, says who? Says who? Let's figure out who that person actually is. What influences are shaping their imagination? What experience, what background education? Where do they live? What knocks have they suffered, right? What hard edges of life have they encountered that are invisible to me? When I was young, I traveled to East Berlin. It was 1983. It was my first time there. This is back before Germany was one country, right? We had East Germany and West Germany. And to get to East Germany, you took a train and they put paper over the windows so that you could not see out the windows. When we arrived in West Germany, West Berlin, it was just a thriving city center. And my friend and I decided to visit East Berlin that day. And of course, it was hot and sunny and we were excited to, you know, be in the summer on this trip. So we go to Checkpoint Charlie, the infamous gate between East and West. And we walk through this canvas tunnel and we pop out the other side. And I will never forget my body reaction. This is the thought I had. You mean the sun shines in East Germany? Like, literally, it was a sunny day. It was actually beautiful. There was a bridge and a river and the buildings had windows that were glinting. And I had been raised during the Cold War. All I had ever pictured of the Iron Curtain, picture the word iron, which is gray, was gray skies. And I didn't know that about myself until I got there. And the reason that's important, because obviously it's an irrelevant fact to whether or not that's a good place to live or whether or not communism is good. But why it's important is because I was so controlled by the rhetoric, I had even altered how I saw the weather. I had even altered how I understood beauty, that it wasn't even possible for beauty to exist for a person who was living under communist control. So I think a lot of times this interrogation is really important. I'll give you one more quick example. 9/11 was, of course, a moment where a lot of Americans reacted to the idea that Muslims were attacking America. And it put a lot of Americans on the defensive about Muslims. But my husband and I had lived in Morocco for 4 years. And we immediately knew that most Muslims are like me and my husband. And so after 9/11 occurred, my husband said to me, you know what? Let's go take some donuts to the local mosque and just check in and make sure everybody's okay. And so that's what we did 2 days after 9/11. And I share that with you, not to pat ourselves on the back, but to show how the difference of experience leads you to a different appreciation for these global events. Sometimes we just do not have enough experience outside of our own bubble to understand all the dynamics at play. And yet we keep doubling down on the only perspective available to us.
And that gets into the second half of the book, which is, boil it down to three words, and that's read, experience, encounter.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we put a lot of stock by reading because we're told that a well-read person is well-educated. And there is some truth to that. We can digest more information more quickly through reading than any other tool. You know, even watching a movie is slower than reading a book. So reading is very efficient, but it's also super safe. I mean, I remember reading about the Holocaust while I was tucked into bed, 70 degrees, perfectly safe at home, right? There is a feeling that reading gives us information, but nothing of ourselves are at risk or at stake. So we can read skeptically or openly. We can skip the data or incorporate the data. We can stop reading halfway through. We can decide that the writer is terrible. We have a lot of control when we read. Experience, however, deepens reading. I use this one example. Imagine studying violin by only reading about it. There's no possible way to actually know the fullness of violins without actually hearing one. Experience enriches anything you would have read about it. And interestingly, what if you had only ever read about orchestral music and then stopped by one of these bars in Kentucky and heard bluegrass fiddling? Suddenly, a completely new experience of violin is available to you. So experience gives sort of a three-dimensional view of whatever it is that you are studying. But the third mechanism that I think really drives it home is what I call encounter. Encounter, the root of that word is adversary. It is the feeling that you are in a power differential that is not in your favor. So taking the violin notion one step further, encounter would be if you put the violin in my arms and asked me to play. Now I know that I am no longer a master of this information. It is having its way with me. And what I'm about to learn is going to inform everything I've read and everything I've experienced up to that point, because I am now actually dealing with the root of what the violin is. Encounters are most often with people. I really highly recommend increasing your social network to include people who are deeply unlike you. This is how we start to actually learn. We can't just read about them. We don't just take planes and visit them. Getting to know them helps us grow the capacity to be a critical thinker.
You're right that, you know, critical thinking needs caring and empathy. And I was struck by the idea of gameplay being critical, whether it's a board game or a video game or another way in which you're interacting with other people, that helps build that sort of caring.
It does. I think games are powerful because kids do care about winning. So because they care, they're more likely to strategize. They're more likely to put in the effort to overcome obstacles. And there are games today that are organized around all the players beating the game itself. For instance, the pandemic game, ironically, is one of those kinds of games. So there are a variety of styles of games that encourage relating to other people, collaboration, competing, learning the heart of those skills. And then, of course, online games give your imagination the capacity to experience some things that you can't experience in real life. I remember reading one study that said Grand Theft Auto is a safe way to experience what a lawless world would be like. And I found that so delightful to consider that that's what's happening there. And that's why it is fun. They know that nothing is truly at risk, but they are also, these teenagers are also experiencing the consequences of lawlessness. And I would dare say there's rarely a kid who finishes playing that game who says, well, this is how it should really be in society,
yeah,
right? So we're giving them like these opportunities to exercise what I call the rhetorical imagination, the capacity to imagine a variety of viewpoints and hold them, as you keep saying, dispassionately.
All right. The name of the book is Raising Critical Thinkers. Julie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was really, really fun.
Julie Bogart is the creator of the Brave Writer program that teaches writing and language arts to homeschooling parents and their children. Her latest book is titled Raising Critical Thinkers, A Parent's Guide to Growing Wise Kids in the Digital Age. It's published by Tarcher Perigee. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.